What time is it? I'll tell you the poem. I must fetch it up upstairs, and I'll read it to you for the 8th of May. You put it on the 8th of May. So, I was born in Lyon, France, 30th of September, 1905. Saw my first film that impressed me a lot. Sometime in April, after the 12th of April. 1912. The newsreel showed the sinking of the Titanic. That gives the date. And the first film was Quo Vadis. That was my mother. I went to school for the first time in 1st of October 1911. I was exactly six. I knew already reading and writing and could multiply, add, subtract, and divide by one figure. My mother taught me that. Now, I passed my first examination in my life, 1917. And then, the second one, 1921. Third one, 1921. 1923. 1922 and 23, more examinations. I went to the university 1923-24. I went to 1924 in January, in fact, because I was in Greece for the end of 1923. Landed in Greece for the first time, 9th of August 1923, and left Greece on the 5th of December 1923. Entered the university in Lyon, where my parents were living. Passed my first examination in June 24. I entered the university in 24, January. Passed the first examination. It was an examination in psychology. 24, June. 25, February. Passed my second examination in the university about logics, with Mr. Gobleau as a master. Passed my third examination in June 19th, 1925. Ethics and sociology. That is the examination in which I had the question, the idea of progress, and answered just as I would answer today. And had 18, I had the brilliant examination, I had an average of 18 out of 20. Nobody ever gets it in the university for the arts. You get it in science, of course, if you have mathematics and it's all right. You cannot get anything else but 18. But in arts, you never get it. My other exams are passed with 14, 15, but never 18. Anyhow, it was a very good one. And then I went to Greece. And, I have another examination. I don't know the date, but it's after this one. After this one, 1926 must be. My last examination for the new university to get the MA. All these four together makes an MA. Licence. Licence est lettre. Then I went to Greece. Went to Greece to prepare my thèse complémentaire, this is to say, to have a doctorate, what they call a state doctorate. Doctorate which, if you are a French subject, gives you the right to teach in a French university. That is composed of two books. You have to write two books for that, and quite thick ones. So I began with the second one, which was the easiest, or I wouldn't say the easiest, but the shortest. It was about the life of Theophilus Kairis, who was a Greek thinker, born in 1784, and died, as I said, in prison, as I spoke about him already, in 1853, for not believing in the dogmas of the Orthodox Church. And I showed there in that thesis that the spirit of the modern Greeks was just like the same as the spirit of those who condemned Socrates. making religion purely a national affair. And then I came back. I came back from Greece, where I traveled extensively. I went all around Peloponnesus on foot and on horseback, alone. And I came back in November 29, having already finished my second thesis. But it was not printed yet, I had to have the first one. The first one, its subject was, what is simplicity in mathematics, or in science in general? I started writing simplicity in science or in general. And I thought that in order to write something like that, I have to get a smattering of scientific training. Otherwise I can't do anything, right on that subject. And that subject had been given to me by the university teacher, Monsieur Gobleau, Edmond Gobleau, one of the greatest teachers in France, greatest logician anyhow. So I went to the science university when I came back to France in 29. And there I took an examination in physics, chemistry in July 30. Mineralogy, July 30, and biological chemistry, 31 July, and in November 30, general chemistry. If you like, it is a whole licence et science, physics, chemistry. I got that in 31. And then I sat to write my greater thesis. But in the meantime, Monsieur Gobleau had died. Mr. Souriau, Etienne Souriau, who is now teaching at the Sorbonne, was the teacher. And he said, don't write on simplicité dans les sciences, simplicité in sciences, it will be much too long. Confine yourself to simplicité mathématique, mathematical simplicity. What is the essence of it? Analyze that. And that took me 500 pages or more. And he made me write, he told me that I should write a part of my thesis on the mathematical theories of Mr. Braunschweig. I didn't intend to write about Mr. Braunschweig at all, but my teacher obviously insisted on it, so I had to do it. Well, it was about mathematics anyhow, it was not about anything else. The thesis was finished and printed at my parents' expense, like the other theses. Both theses were finished. And they were printed in 1934. In the meantime, I went to India, 1932. And then I came back. The theses were printed in my absence, and the proof sent to me. And then I came back, just for the soutenance de thèse, that is to say, to have a discussion about the subject with six professors. There was one professor of mathematics, one professor of Greek, and four professors of logics, different subjects of philosophy. And the soutenance de thèse took place in Lyon on the 1st of April, 1935. And I went back to India at once. I had no time to waste because I had already a job waiting for me in India, in a college, to teach English history and Indian history. Jalandhar, not very far from Delhi. And I took that job. And then I went to Calcutta. Oh, I went to Mathura. I worked in Mathura for 1 year, 1936. 36, 37. I went again to Jalandhar, and I left Jalandhar, 37, no, 36. 36, we came to Calcutta. End of 36. I can't remember exactly when it went. I get mixed up in all this. Anyhow, 36, I came to Calcutta. Now, long before, in the south, when I was in the south, because I landed in India through Ceylon, and my first time in India was in the south, And in the south, I had an experience. In Trichinopoli, I was looking at the town, looking at the magnificent temple nearby, the temple of Sri Rangam, from a distance, bulging out of the tropical vegetation. And there was a boy chanting in Sanskrit on the platform. It was platform of the hill. The temple is on a hill. It's called the Golden Temple because it's covered with gold. And I looked the other way, and I saw a kind of box, an enormous building full of windows, ugly as ugly can be. So I asked the people at Wadhara, I said, "What's that thing?" "Oh, that's the Jesuit hospital." I said, "Good. They came to destroy this Sri Rangam temple. Such a beautiful thing. And to build that. If I can possibly fight this importation of Christianity in India, I shall do it." And I went all over South India with a magnifying glass, figuratively, of course, trying to find an organization standing up for Hindu, or that is to say, Aryan tradition, against all philosophies of equality and all religions of equality. I found none. When you had been a Hindu and you went out of Hinduism in those days, in the south of India, and even today, I think, in the south, you cannot come back to it. So I went up to the north. I came to Bengal. I stayed 6 months in 35. 35, yes, the last 6 months of 35, in Shantiniketan University, in order to learn Hindi and to perfection my Bengali. I had learned Bengali already. I could speak it and rewrite it. And I learned how to speak and write Hindi in Shantiniketan. I met this famous Margaret Spiegel, of which I talked about already, in Shantiniketan, who told me I was worse than the whole pack of National Socialists all in one. A very great compliment. And then I joined the Hindu Mission. The Hindu Mission, Calcutta, was an organization headed by Satyananda Swami in order to bring back to Hinduism people that had severed from it, Indians who had severed from it, and make the greatest number of Indians possible call themselves Hindus, whether they were or not. Because according to Hindu tradition, the Aborigines are not considered the Hindus, nor are the untouchables. But the British had introduced democracy into India. One man, one vote. And they were all voting. And they had introduced the communal award, voting by religion. The Bengal Assembly, Bengal having 55% Mohammedans, the Bengal Assembly had to have 55% representative Mohammedan. So you could only change that in making a few Mohammedans convert to Hinduism. And that's what the Hindu Mission did, in spite of the tradition that doesn't want any former Hindus, once he has been converted to Islam or Christianity or anything else, to re-come into his caste. Hindu Mission took them back into their caste, only for that. I worked for the Hindu Mission years and had to travel all over Bengal, Bihar and Assam, lecturing in Bengali, mostly in Bengal and Assam, lecturing in Hindi in Bihar. I was allowed to sprinkle my lectures with other things, especially with quotations from Mein Kampf, as much as I liked. When I came to Satyananda Swami, I told him frankly, I said, "I have not come to India for anything else but to try to find a tropical equivalent of our old religions of Aryan Europe. And in fact, if you want to ask me what is my faith, I don't admit any faith, any faith of mine except Hitlerism." He said, "All right, Hitler to us is an incarnation of the gods, incarnation of Vishnu. He came to put things right. So you are welcome. And you can say what you like in your lectures, provided you say it from a Hindu point of view, which I always tried to do, of course." I remained in the service of the Hindu Mission all the years. Of course, staying in Calcutta now and then, and mostly traveling in Bengal, Bihar, and Assam. Earning a lot of experience through these travels, a lot of knowledge about the people of India and the different castes. I met Mr. Mukherjee on the 9th of January 1938. I had been wanting to meet him a long time because I used to read his magazine, the New Mercury, and it was the only Hitler magazine, the only National Socialist magazine in India. I liked it immensely and told some people that I'd like to meet the gentleman who was running it, and they introduced me to him. And as I said already, I think, the first thing he told me was, go back to Europe, there'll soon be war. Go back to him who is in reality, life and resurrection, the only one who is today. And he is the one man in the world who will appreciate you and understand you, first of all, and appreciate you. And the stupid fool I was, I did not go, thinking myself useful in India, and thinking, well, who is going to make quotations of Mein Kampf if I go away in Bengali and in Hindi? I stayed, war came, and on the 29th of September 1939, we married, Mr. Mukherjee and I, in order that I should not be interned. It was the purpose of our union. We had a religious ceremony as well as a civil ceremony. The religious ceremony was made by the Brahmin of the Hindu mission, the priest Girijakanta Goswami, who knew me very well. And he married us in front of a sacred fire, as it was done in the old Aryan days. It's a beautiful ceremony. We're taking as witnesses the stars, moon and sky, moon and sun. Although it was, of course, 10 o'clock at night. Marriages are done at night in Bengal. I wearing a bright red sari, purple sari, and he in white, with garlands of flowers around our necks. And then the Japanese war started, the war with Japan started on the 7th of December 1941. Mr. Mukherjee was working for the Japanese consulate. He was running a magazine for Japanese interests after his New Mercury had been suppressed already in 1937 by the British. He could not go with me to Japan. We were supposed to go to Japan in 1942. We couldn't go. So we stayed in India. We worked for the Japanese, as I told you before. He tried to get information from some Americans that they brought to him, and owing to him, at least 3 aerodromes, top secret, in Burma. American aerodromes were bombed to pieces, and some other things happened too that were not expected to happen. Anyhow, the war ended in November 45. I went back to Europe. Went to England. I left England in 1946 to see my mother in my friends in France. February 1946, and I stayed in France till August 1946. Lost all my luggage in Paris in the 16th of August 1946 in the Gare Saint-Lazare. Came back to England thinking the manuscript of my book, Impeachment of Man, was lost. I had another manuscript of it. It was printed in England. It was printed in India 14 years later, because I couldn't afford to print it before that. It was printed in India. And in England, at first, I went back to England in 1946. At first, I didn't like the atmosphere at all. It was an atmosphere of suspicion. It was an atmosphere of hatred for anything that was National Socialism. I remember, streamers across Oxford Street, Nazi atrocities, one half in the shilling, 1.5 shilling to entrance to see things that were faked, not true at all, first of all. Even if they had been true, I didn't care, couldn't care less, I wasn't going to see them, and waste a shilling on that. I thought that in going to a place that had been neutral during the war, I would get rid of all this atmosphere. So on the 8th of November 1946, I sailed to Iceland and landed in Reykjavik 7 days later, after a very, very stormy journey. And I stayed in Iceland 46, end of 46, and 47. That is to say, I saw a winter in Iceland and a summer. And there I gave lessons. I did all sorts of jobs. To begin with, I even had a very humble job washing plates in a farm for 1 month. I had no money left. Everything was very expensive. I only had £5 with me. So, and then I sailed back to England in 47, end of 47. And there I had to struggle a long time too, until it was possible for Mr. Mukherjee to send me a little money. He was himself in difficulty at the time. He had no job after the war. His past injured him a lot from the point of view of jobs. In fact, he couldn't send me anything until 48. But I already had a job. I was a dresser of the Ram Gopal Dancing Company, which is to say, I used to bother about the costumes of the girls. And the Ram Gopal Company took me all over England and Scotland, and then to Scandinavia, to France again, Paris, and then to Scandinavia. We stayed 2.5 months in Sweden, 1 month in Norway, or something like that. And I knew these countries. I met Sven Hedin in Sweden on the 6th of June, 1948. And on our way back from Sweden to England, on the 15th of June, the night of the 15th to the 16th of June, I distributed my first 500 leaflets, written by myself, with handwriting. I spent 2 nights writing them on 500 papers through the windows of the Nord Express. I spoke of that already. And then we reached England again, end of June. I don't know when it was, possibly 16th of June, 16th of June. And 11th of September, the same year, 1948, I re-entered Germany via Saarbrücken with, this time, 11,000 leaflets and posters to post up, stick up. I passed, with great luck, through the customs of Saarbrücken, by papers hidden in books or hidden in fashion magazines. And I continued this job. I had no money, except my jewelry. I used to sell some jewelry, get some money, and live and continue, sleeping preferably in waiting rooms in the stations, in order not to have the expense of the hotels. And that went on until the night of the 13th of February, 1949. There I met this young man, Gerhard Wassner, gave him some papers, which he distributed and didn't stop distributing when the daylight came. He got arrested, I didn't know it. I came back on the 20th of February, 1949, and got arrested in the night of the 20th to the 21st. Sent to Werl, I came to Werl on the 22nd. Entered Werl. And on the 23rd in Werl, which was the 19th anniversary of Horst Wessel's murder, I came in touch with Herr Theilert, to whom I was to dedicate my second book after the war, Defiance. First being Gold in Defiance. They were all printed in India later. And then I left Werl sometime in 1950, as far as I remember. I might make mistakes in dates, I'm not quite sure. It's long ago, you see, and many things have happened since. They had given me 3 years, but they kept me only a few months due to the intervention of the Indian government that Mr. Mukherjee had put in motion. Some people had wanted my mother to intervene. When my mother had been in the French resistance, she was not going to help a National Socialist. I'm quite right. I admire her for that. I'm very grateful to her that she did not intervene. I didn't want to be freed by anybody, especially not by any former French resistance. She wrote to me a letter, at least, that I liked very much. And she said to me, now you are in prison, think of the eagles that are in prison in the London, in the zoo of your native town. In enormous cages, they are cages. Still, an eagle doesn't want to be in a cage. They have done no Nazi propaganda. And still they are in prison for life. Think of them and don't complain. I was not in the mood to complain at all. I was very glad to be in prison for my ideas. On the 31st of May, 1949, my cell was searched and my manuscript of Gold in the Furnace was taken. And I thought it was taken forever because Colonel Vickers, the head of the prison, told me, if your book is subversive, it shall be destroyed. He told me that on the 10th of June, 1949, when I came to ask if my book could be saved. He said, you are not to ask anything. You are the most objectionable Nazi type I've ever met. He was in Germany since 1945. And I'm not going to give any favor to you. Still, after I had prayed and prayed, not him, but the gods, repeating a certain Sanskrit mantra 21 times, and that for 21 days, I didn't do it on purpose. After 21 days, the directress of the women's section of the prison came in and told me, Muki, they always used to call me Muki, the diminutive of Mukherjee, your things have all come back, and Colonel Vickers is to give them to you, you go to his office. They are given back to you, your book is given back to you. I couldn't believe my ears. I didn't thank Colonel Vickers in my heart of hearts, I thanked the gods only. Colonel Vickers was an instrument, nothing more. Just as I am an instrument, nothing more. And now I got back my manuscript. It was put in a safe place until my release from there. At my release, it was given back to me. Of course, I kept it until I got it sent to India. And it was printed in India in 52. It was printed in India, along with Defiance. Mr. Mukherjee paid for the printing. And the proofs were sent to me, that's why there are so many mistakes in the books. It was printed in India in my absence. And then I was forbidden to go back to Germany, but I went back all the same in 53, as did in the meantime in France. And I gave lessons to live. Mr. Mukherjee should send me some money now and then, but not much. And then I went back to Germany in 53. Or rather, no, I went to Greece in 53, in January or February 53. And via Greece, via Rome, I took a plane to Italy. And in Rome, I took a train via the Brenner Pass to Germany. And I came back to Germany with a Greek passport in my maiden name. And nobody understood anything about it. I was condemned with an Indian passport as Mrs. Mukherjee. I came back with a Greek passport as Miss Maximiani Portas. And I was allowed to stay in Germany. Mr. Mukherjee sent me money. He could then. He sent me 90 marks a month. I lived on my 90 marks a month. And I wrote Pilgrimage. And after writing Pilgrimage, I took back again The Lightning and the Sun. I had already started writing it in 48, but I had not finished it. I had written only one or two chapters, the three first chapters, I think. I continued it. And then I took it to India in 57. 57, I went back to India. It was in, let me see the month, May 37. I went to Egypt first and was the guest of Johann von Leers. Johann von Leers couldn't put me up directly, so he gave me the address of Mr. Mahmoud Saleh, a very, enthusiastic admirer of the Führer, a Palestinian Arab with his wife. And I was in their family. They had two little girls. They gave ancient names to their children, Nefertiti and T, instead of giving them Mohammedan names, anyhow. When I left, the one thing, the one favor Mahmoud Saleh wanted me to give him was a portrait of the Führer. I gave him that. He was very, very happy, very proud of it. He had been in a Jewish concentration camp as an Arab for our cause in Palestine. And came out of it, and he suffered a lot, but came out of it. And he was then the president of the anti-Zionist movement in Cairo. And now from Cairo I went to Tell el Amarna, to the ruins of the ancient Akhetaton, not far from Malawi, in the Middle Egypt. I saw the ruins of Tell el Amarna, came back to Cairo, or rather to Meyadi, where I was living, Meyadi near Cairo. Then I went to Alexandria. From Alexandria, I sailed on a Greek ship to Beirut. From Beirut, I was in Beirut, I was supposed to meet one National Socialist. And in Baghdad also. Unfortunately, it was June or July. They were both out. They were not living in June in these very hot places. So I couldn't see any of them. So from Beirut, I went to Damascus by car. And from Damascus to Baghdad by the ordinary trans-desert bus. It was the second time I was doing this trip. I had done it already in 36. I forgot to say that in 37, I did a trip to the Near East by train and by ship. Taking a ship after I visited Baghdad, I visited Syria, and I came back to India via the Persian Gulf in 37. I forgot to tell that. So this time I didn't come back through the Persian Gulf. I came back by bus via Tehran. Stayed 3 weeks in Tehran to see the place. Went to Pahlavi on the Caspian Sea to see the Caspian Sea. And from Pahlavi back to Tehran, from Tehran to Mashhad, and from Mashhad to Zahidan on the frontier between Pakistan and Persia. The train goes once a week to Lahore. So I arrived on the day the train had left. I had to stay a week in Zahidan. I stayed in the Greek hotel. There are Greek hotels all over the world. And I was quite happy. And I took the train crossing Balochistan. Balochistan is one of the hottest places on earth, a desert of gravel, in which the army of Alexander the Great, when he was coming back to Greece, or supposed to come back to Greece, he died on the way. The 1/4 of his army died of thirst in Balochistan. Of course, I wasn't loaded with a helmet and with an armor as they were. I was in a train in third class compartment. There were third classes still in India in those days. There were in Pakistan at least. In the compartment of the women, Imamun and women, quite indifferent to me. And I thought to myself, as the train entered the desert of Balochistan, I thought to myself, now Europe is far away. Now I can do what I like. Now nobody's going to say a word to me if I sing the horse whistle song. And I stretched my arm from the window and I sang the horse whistle song with all my enthusiasm over the burning desert as a sort of victory. The woman didn't care a bit. She said, you want to sing? Well, sing, it's all right. They even liked the song, some of them. And I reached Lahore. From Lahore, I came to Delhi. I entered the train at Delhi on the 30th of July 1957, having come overland all the way from Europe and Egypt. In the train, I was assaulted. I was in the ladies' compartment, but five women that were with me, they all came down at Mathura, and the train was empty. A man came in and assaulted me, wanting money. I had a terrible experience. He nearly strangled me. And then, you know, I spoke gently to him, and I gave him whatever I had. I had hardly any money, but I gave him what I had. And he got down, he jumped down to the train at the next station. I called the police, but there was no way of taking the friend and finding out where he went. I reached Calcutta 2 days later and went to Mr. Mukherjee's house, flat, and he received me very well. And I stayed there. I stayed there till August. Yeah. August 57, and then I got a job in Jodha near Baharajanda in the province of Orissa. Three German engineers were building a Zeilbahn to get down iron ore from the top of the mountain to the railway station, and they wanted somebody, a German person or a person knowing German, to be a field interpreter between them and the Hindi-speaking or Uriya-speaking people. Well, I don't speak Uriya, but I understand some of it. It's very near Bengali, and Hindi I speak and write. So I offered my services. There were three German engineers from the east of Germany. And people told me, you must be careful. They are certainly very good communists if they are given a job abroad. Well, I found out later on that the first one was not a communist. He had been one, but was not one anymore. And the others were very sympathetic people, extremely sympathetic people, that's all I can say. And I don't want to talk any more of it because I'm afraid somebody might find out which Germans were sent to Jodha near Baharajanda in 1957, and they might get into trouble if I say more about them. I don't know. They are from the east of Germany, anyhow. I was very, very pleased to meet them, especially the third one, the youngest one. I came back to Calcutta in 1958 when the job was finished. The job lasted about a year. And this youngest German came to our house, had coffee with us, and was really very, very sympathetic. Had a nice talk with Mr. Mukherjee. And 30, then I joined the French school in Calcutta and had a job at the French school. I left Calcutta in 60. My mother died in 60. She died on the 25th of March, 60. I sailed back to Europe in August or September 60. I couldn't tell you exactly. Via Ceylon, via South India and Ceylon. I took a Messagerie Maritime ship, third class, landed in Marseille. And then I went to Spain. I was 6 weeks the guest of Scott Sidney in Spain, and I enjoyed it immensely. I met a very great man in him. He's dead now. May his soul be in peace. He was one of the finest people I've ever met. and I'm much honored to have stayed in his house. He invited me after I had sent, which book was it? Golden the Furnace, no. The Lightning and the Sun, I think. One book I had sent him via some other person, via this one. Hans Ulrich Rudel. I was in touch with Hans Ulrich Rudel. I met him in Hanover also. I went to him several times. Very fine man also. Now, of course, I think he's half paralyzed. He has one leg is cut off, I know that. But on the top of that, he has had some stroke since then. Anyhow, from Spain I came back to France. And I got a job as a stopgap teacher in Montbrison. That was from January 61 to November 63. In November 63, I was sent to Saint-Étienne. I stayed there till 64. I had trouble, very good trouble in Saint-Étienne, nearly lost my job because I had said in class that I would rather have died in any German concentration camp rather than under the bombardments of the Allies, rather than at Dresden, for instance, drowned in burning tar in some cellar, the streets having become molten under the heat of the bombardment. I said something like that. And I also put in doubt the tales that were told about what the Nazis did. And I didn't know that one of my pupils, her father was the head of the local section of the LICA, League Against Antisemitism, International League Against Antisemitism. And I got into trouble. I nearly was kicked out. But I was not kicked out. I was just sent to another place, to Firmini. And I stayed in Firmini. 65, 66, 67. Living in Montbrison, of course. I was staying, I kept my little room in Montbrison. Because in Montbrison I used to feed a number of cats. I didn't want to abandon the cats until I found somebody to feed them in my place. And I stayed there till 69 in Montbrison. After I had no longer any job in Firmini, I used to correct copies for a course of teaching by correspondence. I used to stay there and continue feeding my cats. And then I had a job. I found a job in Ireland. And I was going to sail for Ireland in 69, yeah. But at the port, I was told to go back. The Irish authorities thought I was going back to England. And as I was sent out of England on account of my taking part in the Coswells camp in 62, in the meantime I had gone to the Coswells camp, I told you all about that. Well, I was not allowed in Ireland either. I had to go back. And I went to Greece. I didn't know where to go. In Greece I had a very small job and a few private lessons. I stayed there a year. And in 70, I came back to France and was a guest in October 70. I was a guest of Françoise Dior in Ducey, Normandy. And from there I wrote my French book. At least I ended it. I started writing it in 68. 68, 69, 70. And then I came to India, landed by plane in Bombay, and went from Bombay to Pune on the 23rd of June, 71. And from there, I continued my book, of course, all the time, my manuscript. And then I went to Delhi. I came to Delhi on the 11th of August, 71, and stayed at the Hindu Mahasabha office. in one of the guest rooms. Finished my book there. My book was ended in Delhi sometime in August or September, I don't remember exactly. 71. And then I found a job at the French School of Delhi. I was teaching at the French School of Delhi until end of 76. In 77, they did not give me another job. In August 77, until August 77, I was teaching at the school. And then they did not give me another job, on account of my age, probably. And now I'm living on private lessons when I get any. And on a tiny little pension that I get, national security, for having taught 9 years, but 9 years only in France. That's the only thing. And here I am. 17th. I'm staying in this flat since 73. Before 73, I was staying in the South Extension Part 1. And I used to feed a number of cats over there, I said, naturally. And now I go every evening in a scooter to see these cats that are still coming to the feeding place, not knowing that I have shifted to Part 2. And I give them milk and bread and pet food and whatever I have to give them. That's what I can say now. And of course, I continue writing. I'm thinking now of writing another book. I don't know if it'll be in French or in English. If it is in French, it will be called, probably, Ironie et Paradoxe, about the ironical and paradoxal certain events of history, or certain lives of people and things like that. For instance, one paradox is the birth of Goebbels. His father was absolutely against us, a staunch Catholic of Rhineland, and in his memoirs of Goebbels, you get this word, krach mit Vater, every two lines when he's young. Didn't like it at all. And then he meets Adolf Hitler, and his father likes him even less. Anyhow, his father is one of the greatest benefactors of the Hitler movement, without meaning to. And I want to show that so many people do things without meaning to, and sometimes against what they should do. For instance, Nebuchadnezzar, who stormed Jerusalem in 586 BC and took the Jews all in captivity in Babylon. Of course, Cyrus let them go back, those who like to go back, in 538 BC. But they didn't all go back, some stayed in Babylon. Now Nebuchadnezzar, of course, who took them there, thought he was doing a great harm to them. He was destroying the Jewish nation. In the reality, he was doing a great favor to them, because they were an agricultural people and a warrior-like people in those days. They were not great bankers or anything of the kind. The banking of antiquity was in the hands of the Babylonians. We have records of banks, Babylonian banks, of 900 years. Babylon was under the Kassite dynasty, an Aryan dynasty that lasted until 1080 BC. And I must say that the Jews who stayed in Babylon, and who got favor there, they finished by no longer being prisoners, they could go about. They learnt their banking there. That's where they learnt their capacity in banking that they used for centuries later on. Nebuchadnezzar was one of the benefactors, one of the greatest ones. Another one was Titus, who destroyed Jerusalem completely in the year 70. And Hadrian, who destroyed it again, when we say destroyed what was left of it, in 135. After two risings, well, they had so many risings under the Romans, it was not only these two, they had about 100 or 50 risings or more. Instead of keeping them in Palestine, these two anti-Jewish Roman emperors, instead of keeping the Jews in Palestine where they were, They made slaves of some of them, sent them all over the Roman Empire in the slave markets. They took others, they dispersed them. They forbade any Jew to remain in Jerusalem. There were a few in Palestine, they persecuted them too. The result was that they got strewn all over the world. Instead of being one stronghold in Palestine, they were strewn all over the world. And what would have happened if they had been in Palestine was this. In the 7th century, the wave of Islam would have taken them over. There would be no Jews left in the world. They would all be Mohammedans, except perhaps a few, one little sect. But the wave of Islam was so powerful, it took over the whole of North Africa. North Africa was Christian, it became Mohammedan overnight, except for the tiny sect of the Copts that is still alive. The Jews would have been the same. There would be no Jewish question at all in the world. But they were not in Palestine, that's the trouble. Thanks to their enemies, Titus and Adrian, they were all over the places in Europe. They were in Italy, they were in Germany, they were, I don't know where. They had followed the German legions as contractors, of course. They were the best contractors of the German legion, of the Roman legions in Germany and elsewhere. And that is the service these two typically anti-Jewish emperors rendered to them. To those German emperors, we owe the fact that we have the Jews everywhere. This kind of book I want to write. I think it will be interesting if I manage to write it. It's getting ripe in me, slowly by slowly, slowly. It might take 2 or 3 years more. Well, that's all I have to say. Well, I have a poem upstairs. I'm going to bring it down, and that'll be my last. It's called 1953. It was written in Athens, 1953, on the 26th of March, which was the birthday of my friend Hertha Ehlert. And it was written in thinking of her. She was still in Berlin prison, and I was free under the sunshine. And I thought of her, and I wrote that poem. I'm going to fetch it. And time rolls on, and every empty day that slowly fades away, as uneventful as any other one into the mist of unrecorded history, brings us along our strenuous way, nearer the heart's desire of the revengeful, nearer the doom of those whom we resist, nearer the unfailing end of this atrocious night, nearer the yet well-hidden goal for which we fight, the one undying dream for which we live, while we never forget, never forgive. And time rolls on, and every dreary hour that passes by into eternity glaringly shows the soundness of our claim, and tells the world the inanity of thy enemy's victory, while bringing thy dismembered nation new strength and new prosperity, new hopes of unity, with the increasing certainty of our return to power, and both our persecutors further fears of unavoidable annihilation. And thus we march invincibly towards our lofty aim along the way of blood and tears. It matters not how much we gave, it matters not how much we shall yet give, to see all those who hated thee descend into thy grave, after they groan under our whip for years and years, for we never forget, never forgive. And time rolls on, and every fleeting second brings us further away from the long nightmare of defeat, nearer the glory of our dawning day, nearer the time we shall begin again, nearer the morn of thy unending reign, when thy adoring people shall repeat in frenzied, spell-like cheers the now forbidden words of faith and pride, and when, for countless scores of years, the nations of the West that have refused to side with thee and fight the common foe and live will lie in ruins at our feet, while we never forget, never forgive. And time rolls on, with us they did not reckon when setting forth their vast utopian schemes. They thought thee dead, and us also. They thought our faith had slackened. They thought, the fools, that they could rely upon our loyalties to values which we hate. They thought They could send us to die without us ever alas asking why, when we had grown too weary to say no. They thought they had become the masters of our fate. And here we are. Rise, and here we stand, and give the world to understand that we shall never fight but for our same old dream, for honor and for might, and what we know is right, for the joy of asserting the privileges of our birth, for thee, for greater Germany, for Aryan rule upon this earth, the gospel of perennial truth in its new form, which we came to proclaim, and which is more to live, while we never forget, never forgive. And time rolls on. Nothing can break our spirit, nor alter our allegiance to thee and to the German Reich, home of the best, stronghold and hope of Aryan mankind in the West. Of all thy enemies can say or do to gain our favor that they so require. Nothing can shake our faith. Nothing can ever mar our loyalty to the old oath. Nothing can kill our will to rise again. Every new step the former great allies take towards us, we meet with a new grievance. No threat can force us to believe their lies. No bribery can keep our hearts from hating both. Happier as the storm draws nigh, we wait and watch events go by. We wait and watch the signs of war, the hopes of liberation, the coming chances of thy nation to seize the lead of sunset lands once more. And we are confident in our own strength, and we are grateful to the immortal gods who made us free, serene even in hell, and loving only thee. Having nothing to lose and all to give, faithful when all become unfaithful, while we never forget, never forgive.